Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries issues, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, EPA Administrator Carol Browner says tougher air pollution regulations are essential for children's health. Recent floods in California have caused $1.6 billion in damage, and some say it's time to learn to live with flooding. Listener questions. This week, it's genetically altered soybeans. We walk in the Minnesota snow with author Kent Nerburn. And in our Earth calendar, chatty fish begin spawning on the reefs. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. Last December, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency proposed tightening regulations covering air pollution. EPA wants to reduce smog by attacking ozone and particulates. Many congresspeople and industry representatives say stronger air pollution regulations will be too expensive to impose. U.S. EPA Administrator Carol Browner says the Clean Air Act requires the existing standards be tightened because human health is at stake, and health, not cost, is what the law says must be considered. In our continuing series of conversations with Clinton administration officials, we caught up with Ms. Browner in the Milwaukee airport. The day before, she had testified about the new standards at hearings of the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works.
Well, we believe that the science is very clear. This is more than 200 peer-reviewed, published scientific studies that show far too many American people suffer adverse health effects because of the levels of air pollution. The Clean Air Act, Congress has been very clear, every president since Richard Nixon has been very clear, that EPA shall set a public health standard to protect the lungs, to protect the lives, to protect the children.
Senator Chafee, chairman of the Committee on Environment, is concerned that the EPA proposals may cause a backlash in the Senate, which could result in weakening the Clean Air Act itself.
We do not believe there is any need to amend the Clean Air Act, particularly the public health protections envisioned in the law. This provision in the law has been there for 25 years. It was in the law signed by Richard Nixon. It was in the amendments adopted by President Carter and most recently President Bush. The law is very clear. It has been very clear that the American people deserve a level of public health protection. They deserve to know whether or not the air they are breathing is clean. What the science shows us is it is not clean enough to protect their health, and what the science tells us is we must strengthen the standards, we must strengthen the protections.
Senator Chafee has also said that instead of dealing with ozone and particulates together, consideration of the particulate standard should be postponed until further health studies are completed.
It's really important to recognize that we are dealing with two pollutants here, commonly found pollutants. One is referred to as smog, the other as soot, ozone or tiny particles. We are addressing them together because there is 10 years of scientific study that shows us we need to act. There are similarities in terms of the health effects that the public experiences from both of these pollutants. And when we move into an implementation phase, when we begin the work with industry to find the common sense, cost-effective solutions to reduce pollution, we can address both pollutants in one process. It will save money, it will save time, and it will allow us to more expeditiously guarantee the American public the levels of health protection they deserve.
Browner says we need the new rules because they will improve the health of all of us.
It will make the air cleaner. It means fewer children will suffer asthma. Fewer children will have to stay indoors on days when the pollution reaches high levels. It means our seniors will not experience premature death, aggravated respiratory illness. That's how it will affect our daily lives. It will make them better. This has never been and will never be about lawnmowers, barbecue grills, or fireworks on the 4th of July. It is simply about the health of the American people and their right to breathe clean air.
Carol Bronner is administrator of the United States Environmental Protection Agency. The floods which ravaged Central California earlier this year tested the belief that we can control rivers in times of high water. Until recently, conventional wisdom led to the construction of levees, dams, and river channels. But those methods often had disastrous effects on ecosystems and failed to achieve comprehensive flood control. Today, a new approach has taken hold, one that seeks to achieve flood control and ecological health at the same time. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has this report.
Around the turn of the year, Central California experienced the worst flooding of the 20th century. 9 people died and 250 square miles were underwater. Damage is estimated at a conservative $1.6 billion. Dr. Jeffrey Mount is the chair of the Geology Department at the University of California at Davis and is the author of the book California Rivers and Streams. He says Californians lucked out.
If you had asked me before this storm to predict the amount of damage that would occur, that is, if you had given me a scenario and said it's going to rain 20 inches in the Feather River Basin and you're going to set high records for high temperature, I would have predicted much more damage than we actually had. And overall, when you sit down and think about it, this was the storm of the century. And so the damage associated with this so-called storm of the century was actually quite limited.
Mount gives credit to the people operating the dams and other flood control infrastructure. Still, he faults that infrastructure for creating a situation where Central California was left particularly vulnerable to flooding. He says the state's 6,000 miles of levees force water to flow through narrow channels, speeding it up. The effects on wildlife are devastating, and downstream, the flooding is worse than it would be otherwise.
One person's failure, one person's disaster, is the saving grace for another person. Because for every levee that failed, you preserved another levee. And that's another lesson I think we're going to learn out of this event, is that failures of levees, which produce flooding on the floodplain, actually preserve levees elsewhere because it takes pressure off of the system. And I think when we sit down and do some serious evaluation, which we're doing right now, when we evaluate all of this, we're going to say, look, what you have to do is decide to give up flood protection in some area in order to promote flood protection in another area. But this kind of a disaster really focuses the political will. And so there is a great deal of talk now about setting up areas that can be flooded and pulling levees back from the rivers and changing the way we actually manage the floodplain and reducing this constant pressure for growth and urbanization on the floodplain. So yeah, right now there is a great deal of political will. I want to tell you, the science has always been there. I'm not saying anything new. We've been talking about this for a very, very long time. My talk of taking down levees and moving levees back, we've been talking about that for decades. The problem is we haven't had the political will to do it.
Mount says flood control measures like dams and levees have created a false sense of security. They don't eliminate flooding, they only make flooding less frequent. This lulls people into believing they can live in floodplains, which are places rivers occupy during times of high water. When flooding does occur, it's often catastrophic, leading to calls for more flood control. Mount calls it a vicious cycle.
Sometime early in the next century, given our current urbanization rates, we will be more urban than agricultural. And all that urbanization is taking place on the floodplain. Nothing beats good land use planning strategies, and that means preserving your floodplains for agriculture and wetlands, and indeed mostly agriculture in this case, because this is one of the richest agricultural areas in the world. By preserving that, you reduce your overall costs. You do not promote development in harm's way. And then when disasters do occur, and large flooding does occur, you don't have this tremendous dislocation of human population, and of course then the natural call for more and more elaborate flood control structures.
Mount says floods are here to stay, so we might as well learn to live with them. That's good news to environmentalists. For years, they've been saying dams, levees, and channels kill rivers, especially wetland areas on the edges of rivers. Katrina Snyder is with the Environmental Defense Fund in California. She says nature has a way to absorb the impact of flooding.
In many ways, what really allows for an incredible solution is to actually preserve the natural hydrology and physical structure where you can. So, for instance, if you restore these floodplains, the river naturally, when it had floods before, would flood out in the flood zone and spread out in a way that it would slow down the waters coming down and also decrease the volume of water that's heading down the river. With the levees so close up to the river reach, there's an inability for this water to spread out as such. So non-structurally expanding the floodplain, for instance, with levee setbacks or recreating the river meander, its desire to weave on down and once again create more of this spreading area, will result in significant solutions for flood management.
The branch of the government most responsible for flood control is the Army Corps of Engineers. In Central California, they oversee a vast network of dams and levees built to protect the world's most productive agricultural area. It's no easy task. Before settlement, Central California routinely flooded during the rainy season every winter. Desert-like for most of the year, this flat valley would sometimes resemble an inland sea. When the Corps built the flood control infrastructure, 95% of the historic wetlands were lost. Lou Whitney is in charge of civil works projects for the Corps of Engineers in California. He admits that dams, levees, and river channels may not be the best way to control floods.
That the Corps is recognizing, just as everyone else is, this certainly isn't just unique to the Corps, that some of the infrastructure that was put in place may not serve the total good as well as it did at one time. Clearly, where we have not been able to combine, let's say, a natural service and, for example, spreading of the water out, then we consistently have the problem where you have a relatively narrow floodway, and if you continue to have more urbanization, then you're going to be concentrating the flows even more, and practically nobody can take that out here in the West, at least relatively limited hydrologic record, and we all do the best we can to project it forward, but you just never know where you are, what kind of cycle you might be in, and so it's hard to project forward. So many of those early systems may be quite a ways, really, from meeting the needs for the future.
In recent years, the Corps has begun to aggressively pursue alternative ways to control floods. Many criticize them for not acting fast enough, but new projects are yielding results. One such project is the Yolo Bypass, north of the state capital in Sacramento. Farmers there are paid to allow some of their fields to be flooded during times of high water. But the real test for flood-prone areas like Central California will be in the future. After the floods, some people living in the floodplain filed suit against the government, blaming them for not doing enough to control the floods. With development increasing, the challenge will be to convince people that they can't hold back a flood. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. We welcome your questions on environmental issues. Just give us a call on our toll-free line. It's 1-888-49-GREEN, 1-888-49-GREEN. Or you can email us at envshow@aol.com. We'll do our best to get you an answer. And this week, Environment Show producer Stephanie Goichman found answers for two listeners.
Here's a question from Matthew Grillo of Amherst, Massachusetts. I recently read that Monsanto had developed a genetically engineered strain of soybean, and it's now being put out in the mass market. Is it safe? If not, what health risks can we associate with it? I know that soybean is one of the biggest agricultural crops in this country. We decided to check this out, so we asked John Fagan, a molecular biologist from Maharishi University in Fairfield, Iowa, with over 20 years' experience using genetic engineering, what he thought. Here's what he said.
They have not, to this date, done studies that directly demonstrate that these soybeans are not allergenic and not toxic to human beings. They have done tests that indirectly assess some of these things, but there is no direct proof that those soybeans are free of allergens at this point. And this is the basic point that, in fact, genetic engineering is a process that is not fully controlled and is capable of introducing unexpected side effects into a food. And when that happens, it will create foods that are toxic or allergenic or reduced in nutritional value. Not every genetically engineered food will be dangerous in these ways, but the risk is there that any one of them could be.
That's one perspective. There are many others, though, who feel genetically altered soybeans are a great advancement in science and that it's quite safe. Next week, we'll hear another viewpoint. On a previous show, we aired a question and answer about pressure-treated wood. Here's a response from a listener.
My name is Mike Notre-Thomas. I live in Syracuse, New York. I heard your program on pressure-treated and chemical-treated wood alternatives, and my comment was just that I feel that I don't think people are going to use the alternatives unless they have some sort of incentive to do so. I don't know if it's because they are not environmentally conscious or maybe they don't know how important it is. But my main point is just an incentive needs to be had. Otherwise, people might not go about doing that.
Here's a question we received on Talking Green from Aileen Cooper in Middletown, New York. She says she has a real deer problem, and although she covers everything with netting, as soon as the wind blows and tips the netting over, the deer come and devour everything. Ray Lesters, a wildlife technician with the College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Newcomb, New York, has this suggestion.
And I would suggest that the lady who asked the question put some wire fencing around the shrubbery. Sometimes there's plastics, but they tend to sag too, so I think that the metal would be the best answer.
Thanks, Ray. If you have a question about the environment, give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN, and we'll do our best to find an answer. You've been listening to Talking Green on The Environment Show. I'm Stephanie Goichman.
We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're on city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. Author Kent Nerburn takes us for a walk in the snow in northern Minnesota. He reads from his book, A Haunting Reverence, Meditations on a Northern Land. It's published by New World Library.
Blue. I walked today, knee-deep in snow that had a sparkle on its surface. Each footstep lifted clouds of winter diamonds, azure blue and crystalline, like fire sparks of ice. It is a day of blue this winter morning. The blue-hued snow betrays its water source within. Tree trunks echo blue in sympathetic harmony. Even the wind blows blue, cool, edgy, soothing, and serene. And above it all, a cobalt sky vaults insurmountable in cloudless brilliance, casting shadows long and lavender across the land. It is the palette of a genius painter this winter day, a Chinese watercolor, but with edges sharp and cutting as a knife. If you would live in winter, you must give yourself to blue. Not as a color or as a winsome sadness, but as a distance receding from the surface that turns at every point to meditation. It is like the echo in a vast architecture, a footfall in a great cathedral. I step. The snow crusts beneath me. Its surface breaks like the shattering of glass. Above me, a jay perches, then swoops, his actions leaving no track or trace, his flight a fugue against the sky. Not so with me. The tracks I leave do not return to stillness, but shape a landscape of intent. Into the blue soliloquy I send a march, a cadence with a purpose. On days like this, I do not love our mortal grounding. I am revealed too much for who I am. I can push forward into endless purity, but if I turn, as honesty demands, I see my history revealed, and my single path betrays the gentle vesper of the land. We may, as Wordsworth says, come trailing clouds of glory, but once that glory touches down, we leave our mark. I would rather seek the margins of the woods than cut a razor path across the land. If I must live, in counterpoint, let it be a gentle sound.
Kent Nerburn, from his book A Haunting Reverence, Meditations on a Northern Land, published by New World Library. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. And as we broadcast, the action is on coral reefs of the Northern Hemisphere, in both the Caribbean and the Pacific. What's happening is the fish are beginning to spawn. As the underwater reefs provide habitat for neither birds nor bees, we turn to Philip LaBelle, Associate Professor of Biology at the Boston University Marine Program in Woods Hole, for an explanation of how they do it.
After the winter season, throughout the Northern Hemisphere, so coming into the time that we're entering now in late February, fishes on coral reefs throughout the Caribbean and the Pacific start spawning. And most coral reef fishes, the kinds of fish that you see commonly in aquariums for sale for people's homes or on public display in, you know, the New England Aquarium and other such places, most of these fishes, when they spawn, exude planktonic eggs and larvae. In other words, some of them build nests, but most of them swim up in the water column and spread their gametes in the water. The eggs and sperm mix and fertilize, and they float away.
The fish sperm and eggs in the water column are known as ichthyoplankton.
The majority of these coastal reef fishes have eggs and larvae that get carried by the coastal currents out into the open ocean. And they drift around there for periods of at least 2 to 3 weeks to as long as 3 or 4 months. And during that time, these larvae go through a whole series of developmental stages, many of which are so different from the adults that one of the major scientific investigations ongoing today is to determine which of these little planktonic larvae in fact grow into different species. They drift around the ocean currents. How they survive is one of the very key questions, because understanding what affects their survival will help us tremendously in predicting if next year is going to be a good year for increased fish stocks.
LaBelle's research has focused on recording the sounds fishes make while they're courting and spawning. He believes acoustical monitoring can provide an indicator of fish health and reproductive capacity. He says listening to fish as they make sounds can be a far more efficient and effective means of research and fisheries management than traditional alternatives.
Now, the difficulty in studying fish populations is trying to identify where and when they're spawning and how many spawn are being produced, how these spawn survive in the weather, you know, the ocean climate patterns, so that ultimately the fisheries managers could predict how many fisheries are available in the future. What we're trying to do is to see whether or not we can acoustically monitor where and when the fish are spawning by identifying specific sounds they make
and then just listening, much like the Navy does for submarine warfare.
Unfortunately, I did not get a chance to ask Dr. Lobel whether his efforts to record fish courtship noises on the reefs as a technique for measuring health of fish species has a human application. If it does, researchers with tape recorders will be swarming the single bars of the Caribbean. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, recently appointed Forest Service Chief Mike Dombeck talks about the forests and the trees. We talk green about co-housing. Is it a way to foster community and save resources, or is it suburban sprawl with a fancy name? And the cicadas of Indonesia provide the backdrop for a new work by the McLean Mix, musicians Priscilla and Barton McLean. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Continuing conversations with environmental and natural resource leaders in the new administration, we speak with Mike Dombeck, recently appointed chief of the U.S. Forest Service. Dombeck is a biologist, as is Jack Ward Thomas, who Dombeck succeeds. In making these appointments, the administration has broken the long tradition of appointing as chief forester someone from the service whose primary orientation has been cutting of trees.
The theme of my tenure as chief of the Forest Service is now and will continue to be sustaining the health of the land through collaborative stewardship. And by collaboration, I mean listening and working together with people. And from the standpoint of the health of the land, everything we do, it's important that we work within the limits of the land, because this land will be here generation after generation after generation. And whether we make investments today or whatever, we're really doing it for our kids and their kids and future generations.
That issue of stewardship, I guess, is one of the things that has been the subject of some contention. The environmental community frequently takes the Forest Service to court, arguing that long-range sustainability and so on is not being maintained. Are there things that you can do, you think, to increase the level of trust, which frequently has been absent between the service and the environmental groups?
Well, let me say that that I think a lot of what we see is the background noise of a healthy, functioning democracy. People exercising their right as citizens of the United States to question their government, to question citizens. And I might want to say that not only are we being questioned by the environmental community, we are as often questioned by the commodity interests. So we, in essence, are being questioned by both sides of the system. And oftentimes, it's not, you know, for our employees as well as myself, it's not very comfortable.
One of the challenges that you face as chief is that to some degree there's polarization within the Forest Service itself. The older managers who are identified, perhaps right or wrong, with the mission of getting out the cut, and some of the younger groups that took a broader view of the environment. Are there things that you think you can do to help unify your own team with respect to that, those differences of opinion?
Well, let me just say, Peter, that the Forest Service is no different than any other organization. In fact, with a large number of employees that we have. We have employees from every walk of life, from all ends of the spectrum working for us. And these employees are valued. And I've got to say that some of the employees that have been around a little bit longer, they were doing what their bosses of the day wanted them to do. That was their job to deliver to the American public the policies of the day. And I've got to say, because of societal value changes, some of those policies are changing. And we need to be able to respond to those policies. And unfortunately, we don't live in a perfect world, so the responses always aren't even.
We hear a lot about sustainable forestry. It's sort of like being against sin. Everybody is for sustainable forestry, but nobody's quite sure that their definition is anybody else's. How do you see sustainable forestry, and how do we achieve it, or are we there already with respect to the public lands of the United States?
What sustainability means to me, it means, you know, healthy forest. It means good hunting and good fishing and cleaner water and recreation opportunities for families to rekindle their relationships, to protecting our cultural heritage. You don't just manage trees by themselves. We manage entire watersheds, ecosystems, and all those kinds of things. And I think one of the things and that challenges that all of us have, not only resource managers, is public education, because sometimes we get so technical that we forget the basics.
Mike Dombeck is the recently appointed chief of the U.S. Forest Service, a division of the Department of Agriculture. He is in charge of managing all of our national forests. We're talking Green on the Environment Show, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we'll be discussing the environmental aspects of co-housing. The concept is that 10 to 100 folks form a group. They buy a piece of land and develop it together. The houses are clustered, and there is often a communal house where resources are shared and many meals are served communally. The first community in the U.S. opened in 1992, and now there are about 400 in progress. Call us with your questions or comments. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. My guests today are Tom Lent, project coordinator for the Berkeley County Community Housing Project in California, and Bruce Coldham, an architect based in Amherst, Massachusetts. He's dedicated to designing buildings which minimize adverse environmental impact. His architectural firm just won a Renew America National Environmental Award for design. Tom, situated in California as you are, is co-housing good for the environment, or is it just more suburban sprawl with a fancy name?
We've actually done just the opposite of suburban sprawl by instead doing urban infill. This project is located in the heart of Berkeley, and we've taken a property and added some more units to it, putting more of us in walking distance of shopping and jobs or easy mass transit. Distance from the shops, from offices in downtown San Francisco. So we're trying to fight the suburban sprawl thing.
And how does your project differ from what any other developer might do?
Well, because we're doing this cooperatively, we're able to make a lot of decisions that other developers wouldn't make to push the envelope in using more environmentally friendly materials, more energy and water conserving design, and to recycle materials and things that a normal developer wouldn't have the time or energy to do, but we do with the extra person power of the whole group behind it.
So, Bruce Coldham is an architect. Is co-housing a real possibility for the future in terms of getting more architecturally green design?
Well, Peter, I think architects and designers are very prepared. And interested in this route, they by nature they tend to be. There are development challenges, and And there's a marketing aspect of this too, just how to what extent are people understanding and wanting to commit to this. It's gathering momentum, and in a sense, it's good that it's gathering it at a moderate pace rather than precipitously, because we've had a chance to make mistakes, to improve upon them, and to refine the model and so forth before it gets too widespread.
So relations between clients and architects are historically difficult. How does it work if you've got 50 or 60 clients all trying to develop the same piece of ground?
It is more difficult. It's true. Having been through this process myself, professional architects might think that they've only got one or two of these kind of projects in them from an emotional, energetic point of view. And that's part of what I mentioned earlier, the learning curve here. I think it is the product is an excellent product. I mean, the idea of clustering housing, sharing facilities, creating an intentional neighborhood, minimizing impact on the land, retaining open space and so forth, is really, it's a wonderful product, and the ones that have been completed around the country demonstrate this.
Well, let's go to the phones, and I see we have a call from Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Lowell, welcome to Talking Green.
Thank you, Peter. Nice to be on the show. I like it a lot. I'm involved with a group here that's in the formative stages of creating a co-housing project, and we've got a little twist on it. We're in a very rural area, and consider it part of our obligation to conserve land. And so we're looking at buying a large piece of land and building a cluster of homes on a small portion of it, but deliberately preserving the bulk of the land and even to make it available for agriculture.
Now, does that mean that you will restrict the rest of the land? What happens if all your co-housing partners a few years later say, heck, we want to get into the development business like everybody else?
Good question. No, it'll be a restriction in the deeds of people's property. We want to create the effect of common land and to give permanent protection and agriculture access to the land, the kind of protection that cannot be revoked in the future.
Good. Well, Lowell, thanks for your call. And let's go to New York now. We have a call from Liz Walker in Ithaca. Liz,
Hi.
You're Talking Green in the Environment Show.
Thanks.
Hello, Liz.
It's fun to be here. Hi, Bruce. I work with Eco Village at Ithaca, and this is very apropos about the land discussion, because we have 176 acres. We're right in a small town, the home of Cornell University, and we're preserving 80% of our land. We're planning to eventually build 5 co-housing neighborhoods. We have one that is almost completed with passive solar homes that are super insulated, and the rest of our land, our 80% of open space, is going to be preserved for wildlife. We already have a 3-acre organic farm on it, which grows food for about 200 people a week during the growing season.
And Liz, how did your group get formed? Did your folks all get together first, or have you brought them in as you've developed it? How did it work?
Well, we started out actually with an ambitious 5-day retreat for 100 people who were very excited about the concept. And then we have coalesced, our co-housing group has been a subset of that group, and then we've gotten people from all over the country, mostly actually through word of mouth and the World Wide Web. And
well, let me ask all of you something that I think bothers some, and that is, doesn't this sound a lot like, again, a fancier version of the gated community, a group of moderately affluent folk who get together and put a fence around it, in effect, keeping out people of differing views and ethnic origin and so on? How does that problem square with what sounds like a pretty exclusive group of folk who get together and engage in this kind of communal development process?
Well, Peter, that's just not what's happened. I know that often is a perception, and I've seen writings about this and so forth, but co-housing really is a commitment to a community for the purposes of sociability, not for the purposes of exclusion and that kind of security. So they're not gated, at least none that I know of is. And by and large, the people who are members of these communities are more than usually active in their local communities. They are more than likely to be members of planning boards, town meetings, zoning commissions, and so forth. They are generally speaking, the communities here, for example, the common houses are used for community meetings, for neighborhood events, for town events, and so forth. They're very accessible and very open. It's a perception, perhaps, that has to be fought, but it's not a reality.
Right. Let me echo that. We've been the center for yoga classes, town watch, earthquake safety workshops. The city's starting to look to us to help organize in this neighborhood for the kinds of things that the larger neighborhood needs beyond us. We have the facilities that we can bring people together in ways that people can't in their individual houses.
Liz, in your operation, is there any process by which you screen folk? I mean, there are the concerns about bias, but also it seems to me there are legitimate concerns. If you're all tied into this together, everybody has to be financially responsible and so on. How have you handled those kinds of issues?
Well, we don't have a formal screening process other than asking people to commit to the basic bylaws and agreements that the community has already made. And we do have guidelines for development for the overall project, which call for a great deal of environmental awareness. People do have to be financially able to build a house, and that doesn't include everybody. We're hoping that in our second neighborhood we can push the envelope in terms of making housing more affordable through doing even smaller homes and various designs to keep the prices down. In terms of being open and accessible to the broader community, what we find is people are so thrilled with this concept that we're getting visitors from all over the place, not only all over the country, but all over the world, who come to us and are eager for tours, they're eager for information, they want to do it themselves. So we feel very open, and in fact that can be a problem because you can only give so many tours a month before you burn out.
You don't want to live in a zoo. Well, thank you for your call. In case you're just tuning in, we're talking Green on the Environment Show. I'm your host, Peter Burley, and our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Bruce, I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the environmental impact of the building process and the design of what goes on in a co-housing operation. Does this provide real opportunities to deal with some of the traditional environmental problems with new development of a lot of infrastructure and too many roads and that kind of thing? What are the opportunities that co-housing present to lick some of the traditional suburban development environmental problems?
Well, Peter, there are two main things, I think. There's a lot, but two mainly. First of all, if you're sharing a common house and so forth between houses, you really have to be able to get to it easily to make it worth investing in, which means that you have to be very close to it, which that's what drives clustering and pulling these communities very close together. And that, in turn, means that there's a fair amount of open land that's maintained in co-housing developments, much more than there is in usually. It also means that there's less roadways, less surfaces that cause runoff and so forth. There's more land available for percolation. The other thing that's really important, and this really hasn't had a chance to be developed yet, but I think it's the opportunity for the future here, and that is that there's some really useful technologies that co-housing allows to be used. I'm thinking, say, for example, of shared heating systems. Typically, every house has its own heating system, and if you were to want to use a renewable energy source, for example, such as the sun or biomass, the real efficient, environmentally sound way of doing this is with one central system where the heating is distributed out to the units. But that can only really happen when you have buildings very close to one another and where you've got some kind of organization which is really set up and robust enough to manage a shared system. Composting also works better when you have 20 or 30 people using one big heap rather than just one person.
Now, Tom, your operation in California is in an urban area, so is it without the traditional large amounts of open land that are frequently associated with these projects?
Right. We don't have the opportunities to save large amounts of open land since we're squeezing into a very densely built environment already. However, the concepts that Bruce raised about sharing work not only in the technologies that he mentioned, all of which are ones we're integrating into our project, but also into daily living. As a parent of a four-year-old, I can vouch that my driving is is reduced dramatically since I moved into co-housing, as shared childcare, having a lot of Jamie's buddies right across the green where he can run to visit them instead of my shuttling him to play dates, shared entertainment, shared food shopping, all reduced the amount of trips that I need to take. Whether I was in an urban setting like this or a suburban setting, it can make a radical difference.
Let me ask you something about that. Does this require separate houses? What about the good old-fashioned apartment house? Would that work in this kind of a co-housing concept?
It certainly could work in an apartment house. We looked at some options like that before we found this particular property. The important thing that differentiates this from the next step down the line there of the communal house, however, is that there are at least separate distinct units with their own kitchen facilities, so you have the option of being as community-oriented or as private as you need to be on a day-to-day basis.
You can be in the commune or out of it, which sounds
exactly.
like a great option.
So it gives you, it gives you that kind of flexibility that I think was lacking in a lot of other more common experiments that led to people burning out from them more rapidly.
Let's ask something very specific. I'm a listener to the Environment Show, and I've heard this, and I think this might work for me and a group of my friends. How do I get started? Where do I go? How does this idea get formulated in any particular community?
Well, if you're the first thing to do is find more people who think like you. It takes a goodly group of people working together to pull this off. And you can do searches on the World Wide Web under co-housing to find a number of web pages that are discussing different groups that are working. Or if you don't have access to that, there are a number of phone numbers you could call, including maybe the co-housing company keeps an extensive list of groups throughout the country that are in various stages of development. And their phone number is 510-549-9980. Do you have any other favorite resources, Bruce, to direct people to?
Yeah, I was going to direct people to the Co-Housing Network, which is right in your back doorstep, and in fact, the director of which is a neighbor of yours. But the Co-Housing Network is also in Berkeley, and that phone number is 510-526-6124. And they publish the Co-Housing magazine, which has been in circulation as a quarterly now for almost 10 years. And there's a fascinating a bunch of information in that magazine. I think that would be maybe a first step for people.
Great.
That's an excellent resource. And there's also a user group on the Internet that parallels it well.
Great. Well, I want to thank you both. We've been talking green with Tom Lent, who is project coordinator for the Berkeley Co-Housing Project, and Bruce Coldham, who is an architect based in Amherst, Massachusetts. I'm your host, Peter Burley. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Nature has its own music, the likes of which would make Mozart green with envy. The call of an eagle echoing off a lake in a distant cliff, bullfrogs croaking up a storm in a swamp, whales calling to each other from hundreds of miles away. For Priscilla and Barton McLean, known as McLean Mix, the sounds of cicadas in Indonesia are the inspiration for their latest composition. McLean Mix specializes in incorporating natural sounds, especially from the rainforest. They put it in their music. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally recently had an opportunity to speak with him.
For years, Priscilla and Barton McLean have traveled around the world looking for natural sounds to incorporate into their music. They've used animal sounds, self-made instruments, Eskimo chants, and even rocks. Their most recent release is Rainforest Images, which includes sounds from the Australian and South American rainforests. The McLeans are now working with sound from a trip to Indonesia and are busy working it into a still unfinished work of music. Barton McLean tells us what they found on their recent trip.
Well, we were in this really dark, rather remote jungle, the Kuba area of Borneo, Malaysia. And we had been taking our recording equipment with us all day, and we tried a few places and record some sounds. We were getting sort of just average results. And then all of a sudden, we heard this sound, which I had never heard before. It started very softly, and then gradually got louder and louder. I said, what is this thing? You know, what is this sound? Later on, we learned that these are all a type of mountain cicadas in Borneo. Then a second sound came up. This is in the same place. I've tried to isolate the sounds. Of course, they can't be isolated in the rainforest, but this is the one that we heard, like a bassoon. And finally, the third one is the strangest one of all. It was kind of like a violin, kind of a drunken violin player. I'm not kidding you. That's an actual insect. You know, it sounds like it's an electronic sound, but that was the actual sound. And this is what you're going to hear now is exactly what it sounded like in the rainforest with all three.
Recently, Barton McLean and his wife and musical partner, Priscilla, joined us at our home studios in Albany, New York.
The jungle of Borneo is different from any of the others I've ever seen. It's very dark. There are huge dipterocarp trees that go up 200 feet high with very dense bamboo jungle just crowding in. You can't imagine just walking into the jungle without somebody ahead of you with a machete, which is one way we did it with the natives. Those are the previous headhunters, by the way, the Iban native, they call them Dayaks. It's just an impenetrable jungle.
How is this rainforest different from, as far as some of the things you heard, from some of the other rainforests that you've been to?
That's
well,
a good question.
I think the cicadas are just the one thing which is incredibly different. I've heard cicadas. We have them right here, of course, but not like these cicadas. They sing at dusk for 1 hour, and that is it. And the natives are afraid of them. They believe that these cicadas are the voices of their dead ancestors, and they stay away from any spot that they're singing.
Barton and Priscilla McLean, also known as the McLean Mix. The McLean Mix tours the country with their music, inviting the audience to join in the performance. You can contact them by email at mclmix@aol.com. Their most recent release is Rainforest Images. We'll leave you with parts of their composition from the trip to Borneo. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 373. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. Thomas Lally is producer. Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and the Packard Foundation. Also, Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.